This podcast contains murder and mayhem, guts and gore, adult language, and sexual content. Exactly what you came here for. All the listener discretion is advised. Welcome. I am your mistress of the macabre, Sarah Tierra. Grab your Ouija board, light the candles, and grab your jar of human teeth because you and I are going to escape for a bit. Pour yourself a cocktail, pull the window shades closed, and find a cool, dark, quiet place because right now we delve into the macabre. Hello and welcome back to the Mistress of the Macabre podcast. I'm your host, Sarah Tierra, of course. Welcome. We have a big old whopper of a case today. We are talking about the Mad Gasser of Mattoon. Not only does he have his picture on three bubblegum cards, but in the early 1990s, he was immortalized by the Matchbox Inc. company in a series of popular toys known as the Monster in My Pocket series. Figure number 110 was none other than the Mad Gasser of Mattoon. Although the fantastical monster looked nothing like what Mattoon residents reported, it made for a decent toy. Also known as the Phantom Anesthetist or simply the Mad Gasser, the biggest question about this almost mythical figure is, was he a real person or a figment of the imaginations of an entire town? If you want more information, this book is amazing. It's written by a scholar and chemistry teacher. He really did so much research into this case. So go get a copy of The Mad Gasser of Mattoon by Scott Maruna. If you go to Mattoon, Illinois, today and talk to the young waitress at the A&W restaurant who has lived in Mattoon her whole life, odds are she will not have any idea what the fuck you are talking about. There was a time, though, not all that long ago, when this town found itself acting out a bad script for a cheap Hollywood movie, only it was real. Quote, "I've hesitated to write this, hoping and hoping someone connected with your newspaper or some of our citizens would start the ball rolling. But I can't wait any longer. Something must be done to stop the things that are going on to frighten people in their homes. We used to think these things only happened to those who were out in the streets or somewhere else outside of their homes, but now there is no safety, even in one's home with all the doors locked. There are hundreds of women here who are left at home at night alone while their husbands are at work or are in the service. We see by now that our city police cannot cope with such things that have been happening here for the last year. Why not the militia or those who are appointed air raid wardens and block captains? Why not have them patrol every block in the city during the week after the service checks are received and the shop employees get their pay? But this latest outbreak seems to be the work of a crazed mind and must have been done by someone with a knowledge of chemistry. Are we going to let the boys down fighting over there who have left wives and mothers alone? Isn't it up to us to put a stop to such a monster? They're doing their job over there. All you subscribers, start the letters coming in. Maybe some of your suggestions are better than mine. It isn't safe to keep loaded guns around when you have small children in the house, so what can we women do to feel safe in our homes? I know one serviceman's wife who has a lovely home, which she wanted to keep so her husband could come home to it, but since so many terrible things have happened, she was afraid to stay there with her little son. She is fortunate enough to have parents with whom to stay, but those who have nowhere else to go live in fear each night, waiting for daylight to come. Come on, all you American citizens, let's do something to put a stop to all of this. Let's show our boys we are keeping up morale at home too. Signed, a housewife." In the early morning hours of August 31st, 1944, the regular day-to-day existence of a small town in East Central Illinois was dramatically and disturbingly upset. The town was Mattoon, Illinois. This town, which was built around a railroad intersection, is surrounded by rich farmland, and its main employment opportunities are factory labor. This is a small, unassuming town with a population of 16,870 as of the 2020 census, and a search for the population in the year of 1944 turned up nothing, but dramatically less than 16,870, I'm pretty fucking sure. On the night before the fourth Lincoln-Douglas debate of September 18, 1858, at the Coles County Fairgrounds, both Abraham Lincoln and Stephen A. Douglas slept in nearby Mattoon. Lincoln slept in the Essex House Hotel, a popular hotel in those times. Later, Ulysses S. Grant would also use that hotel. Besides that, the only other thing Mattoon was known for was Burger King. The Burger King, unrelated to the Florida-based fast food chain Burger King, is a Mattoon restaurant whose owners claim it as the original Burger King. In 1968, they sued the national chain Burger King, producing a well-known case in United States trademark law. The federal Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that federal trademark registration has priority over state law, giving the national Burger King chain rights to the name beyond a 20-mile radius around the original Burger King. Today, the closest Burger King franchise location is 25 miles away in Tuscola, Illinois. And the Burger King of Mattoon is still around. But most of all, Mattoon is known for becoming the major focus point for the modern study of what is most commonly known as mass hysteria. Most college students studying sociology or psychology, reading a well-known chapter on collective behavior, are introduced to a mysterious and frightening character known as the Phantom Anesthetist, or the Phantom Gasser, or the ever-popular moniker, the Mad Gasser of Mattoon. Back to August 31st, 1944, which is also the night that the city of Whitechapel, England, began a terrifying saga of blood and murder, with Jack the Ripper's first victim being murdered on August 31st, 1888. So what really happened in Mattoon of 1944? In the quiet early morning hours of Thursday, August 31st, 1944, Urban Rafe woke up feeling sick and nauseous. He woke up his wife asking her if she had left the gas stove on. Urban felt weak to the point of almost being paralyzed, and to his horror, his wife felt the same. They noticed a heavy odor in the room, but Mrs. Rafe was confident that she had not left the stove on, and later checked it, and she was right, it was not on. The couple began to vomit, and they staggered out of the bedroom. They had overnight visitors in the house that night, and when they checked on them, they reported them to be not affected in any way. Though convinced that there was a gas present at the time they awoke, but being unable to find any source, the Rafes wrote their strange incident off in their minds as an unfortunate case of food poisoning from a dinner of hot dogs the evening before. The next night, two sisters, Martha Reedy and Aileen Kearney, were with their children at Mrs. Kearney's home. It was a mild, late summer evening, and the sisters were at home, counting the government check money that Aileen had cashed earlier that day. They admitted they could probably have been seen counting it from the door or windows that faced the street as they were open. They finished shortly after 11 p.m. and they went to bed, Mrs. Kearney bringing her 3-year-old daughter with her. She tucked her daughter into bed and got into bed herself. But right away she noticed an overwhelming, quote, extremely sickly, sweet odor, end quote. She convinced herself it was just the flowers outside the window, but the longer she and her daughter Dorothy stayed in the room, the stronger the smell got. Just as she started to get fully freaked out by the smell, she noticed her throat was becoming extremely dry, her lips had started to burn, and her legs were quickly losing sensation. Panicked, Mrs. Kearney screamed for her sister Martha, who was in the other room. Martha came running, and upon opening the door to her sister's room, immediately noticed the pungent odor and ran to the home of the next-door neighbor, Mr. Earl Robertson. Robertson called the police and then did a quick search of the Kearney's property, but turned up nothing. The police came and were not able to find any clues other than the rapidly diffusing odor. Bert Kearney, a taxicab driver working the night shift that evening, rushed home at 12:30 a.m. upon finally hearing what had happened to his family. Pulling up in front of his home, Mr. Kearney spotted, quote, a man at the window, tall, dressed in black cloth, and wearing a tight-fitting cap, end quote. Mr. Kearney ran after the man, but the prowler was too fast and ended up getting away. Mrs. Kearney had almost completely recovered by this time, and it was reported that young Dorothy, also made nauseous by the gas, had recovered by morning. Not too long after the Kearney situation was quieting down, yet another home was gassed. Mrs. George Ryder informed her husband upon his returning home from work early Saturday morning that during the night she had noticed an odd odor in the bedroom that made their children, Joe and Anne Marie, nauseous and, quote, extremely restless, end quote, and caused her to vomit and feel lightheaded. She later noted that it did not smell like chloroform, a gas many initially assumed to be the culprit. In a house just west of the Ryders, a young mother, unnamed in a police report, was awakened by a sickly sweet odor drifting through her house. Upon getting out of bed to investigate the source, she found all of her children in their bedroom, quote, ill and vomiting, end quote. They had shown absolutely no signs of illness upon going to bed. The Kearneys were the only family who immediately contacted police about their incident, so the Saturday edition of Mattoon's Daily Journal Gazette only carried a front page headline of, quote, anesthetic prowler on the loose, end quote. And the article only mentioned the Kearneys. Oddly enough, the article's subheading was, quote, Mrs. Kearney and daughter are first victims, end quote. Why the paper chose to use the term first when there was, at the time of publishing, no knowledge of any other victims is still unknown. The three other families, upon reading that another family had shared a similar frightening experience, immediately came forward to police with their stories as well. Within 48 hours, the gasser had attacked four residences, all within 8 blocks of one another. Then, there was nothing. Saturday, Sunday, and Monday night all came and went with not the slightest scent of gas. Upon talking to the Kearneys, the police were told about the fact that they had been counting money, and the police deducted that they were dealing with a common burglar, albeit one with a very unusual MO. But when three more victims came forward, their fears were heightened. There was no obvious motive. There was no commonality in targets. The police slowly came to terms with the idea that they might be dealing with a demented individual. Newspapers picked up on this fear and coined this prowler the mad anesthetist. When nothing else happened for a couple of days, the police were like, phew, glad that's over, and assumed he had left town. The police then spread this news around town to assuage the fears of the townspeople. Well, the hopes of both were dashed on Tuesday, September 5th. Around 10 p.m., local couple Balula and Carl Cords arrived home, pulling up behind their house and entering the rear door. They settled in the living room to relax when Mrs. Cords noticed a white cloth on their front porch, leaning against the screen door. Curious, she went and picked it up and saw that the center of the cloth was soaked with liquid. Quote, without thinking, I brought the cloth to my face and smelled it. When I inhaled the fumes from the cloth, I had a sensation similar to coming in contact with an electric current. The feeling raced down my body to my feet and seemed to settle in my knees. It was a feeling of paralysis, end quote, she later told police. Mr. Cords had to assist his wife back into the house. Her lips were beginning to swell to the point of cracking and bleeding, and she reported that her throat and the back of her mouth began to burn. Then she began spitting up blood. Not victim blaming, but like, if someone leaves a weird cloth on your doorstep, don't put it in your face. Just don't do that, please. Thank you. Mr. Cords called a doctor, but the symptoms began to calm down after a couple of hours of rest. Her lips, however, were still swollen the next day. Once she felt better, Mrs. Cords went to the front porch to search for more clues, because she's a Nancy Drew-ass bitch, like I am, and that's exactly what I would do too. On the sidewalk just off the porch, she found a well-worn skeleton key and a nearly empty large lipstick tube. She found a skeleton key. Dun, dun, dun. What a cool clue to find. And a nearly empty large lipstick tube. Weird. When police finally arrived, they took the soaked cloth and had it sent to the Illinois State Police Laboratory in an attempt to identify the chemical. But for inexplicable reasons, the chemical analysis test did not occur until over 60 hours had passed, giving the chemical more than enough time to evaporate, rendering it unidentifiable. Mattoon's acting chief of police, C.E. Cole, noted that a man was picked up near the Cords' home shortly after the incident had been reported. The man, whose name was withheld, was released when he told police that he was simply lost. The author then says, quote, I spent my entire youth living within 10 miles of Mattoon. Knowing this town well, I find it very difficult to picture someone wandering around this small community lost, end quote. I think that is a fair and interesting point to make, and I bet I know who that man was. And you will too, but like 2 hours from now. The next morning, Thomas Wright, Mattoon's police commissioner, called the Illinois Department of Public Safety to have them consult on the case. They sent two men from the Bureau of Criminal Identification and Investigation who arrived the next day. At approximately the same time, two agents from the Springfield branch of the FBI also quietly arrived in town. They would not comment on their specific objectives except to state that they were solely interested in identifying the chemical being used. Also, if the FBI's there, pretty sure it's not just mass hysteria and nothing's happening. On Wednesday, September 6th, the downtown area of Mattoon was a hub of activity. Shoppers? Diners? People hitting the town pub? No. The streets were filled with Mattoon police officers. Day shift officers were even asked to pull double shifts to ensure public safety. There were also numerous bands of shotgun-wielding vigilantes. I said it before, I'll say it again. I love a vigilante. Every single street was packed. With police and townspeople taking this so seriously, you'd probably guess the gasser would lay low for the night. That's what I would think. But that's not what happened. Gasser said, fuck the police and fuck this town, and struck a whopping 7 residences all in this one night. The balls, the hubris, the gall of this man. The lion, the witch, and the audacity of this bitch. It's like he wanted to embarrass the shit out of this police department and terrify the entire town, and he's doing a good job of it so far. Okay, so let's start at the very beginning of this night of terror. It all began at 10 p.m. at the Big Four restaurant. The restaurant's manager, Mrs. Laura Junkin, that's a great last name, Junkin, come on, had an apartment in the back of the restaurant. It was common in the early fall for the people of Mattoon to leave their windows open, and she had left her bedroom window open to get some fresh air. When she entered her bedroom that evening, she immediately noticed that the room was filled with a scent that was reminiscent of, quote, cheap perfume, end quote. Inhaling the fumes made her legs become weak, as if paralyzed. An hour later, Glenda Hendershot, the 11-year-old daughter of Mr. and Mrs. R.E. Hendershot, became nauseous in her sleep. Just 2 hours earlier, her parents had spotted and reported to police a suspicious prowler near their daughter's bedroom window. At approximately midnight, Mrs. Ardell Spangler smelled, quote, sickly sweet fumes, end quote, in her bedroom. She was immediately nauseous, and within minutes, her lips and throat became parched as if burned. At 1 a.m., 60-year-old Fred Goble woke feeling violently ill from something that had apparently been sprayed in his bedroom window. The vomiting lasted for approximately 2 hours before clearing up. The gasser was apparently a bit careless with this attack, though. Mr. Goble's neighbor, Robert Daniels, happened to be up late and spotted a, quote, tall, thin man, end quote, running from the Goble house and through his yard at the same time as the apparent attack. 3 other homes were attacked, adding to the growing list of victims. Mattoon was now fully in a panic. Women whose husbands were away at war moved in with friends and neighbors. Children were not allowed out after dark. Windows were closed and locked, no matter how hot it was inside their homes. There were even instances of injuries sustained while trying to protect homes and family members. Mr. Hiram Weaver was concerned for his daughter, who was preparing to clean an empty house in town late in the evening. Hiram insisted on searching the premises before she entered, terrified of the gasser. During his search, he stumbled down an open flight of stairs into a cellar, shattering his pelvis. On Thursday, September 7th, there was a triple gas attack all on one single home, which was the only target that night. Frances Smith, the principal of the nearby Columbia Grade School, and her sister Maxine were hit by the first wave of gas while in their beds. The gas smelled of flowers and caused the ladies to gag and choke. Partial paralysis crept into their arms and legs, and they sat helplessly in their beds, fearful of what was to come. Soon, another round of gas came through the window, and this time they saw it. Bluish smoke-like vapor filled the room while they heard a buzzing noise outside their bedroom window as the gas came pouring in. This happened twice, so the one time they didn't see, and 2 more times that they did see the gas. They didn't know what to do and stayed frozen in their beds while their arms and legs slowly became paralyzed. Somebody is pissed at Frances. The next afternoon's paper featured a scathing editorial on the gassings. Quote, probably the only comfort we can get out of the whole situation is that our police department is now on the alert, apparently doing everything in its power to solve the case and take into custody the guilty person. All of us join in hoping for early success, end quote, it read. If you're saying to yourself, that wasn't scathing, what is she talking about? This is a quote from the newspaper. Quote, one of the principal difficulties throughout has been that the whole matter was taken too lightly. It was easy to say, oh, it's just imagination, and shrug the whole thing off with a disdainful air. But Mrs. Carl Cords, who suffered severe burns, couldn't laugh about it. Neither could Mrs. Bert Kearney, who suffered complications, which could have cost her very life. Neither could Mrs. George Ryder, whose 2 youngsters were found vomiting and who was nauseated herself. Neither could any of the other citizens who had the same terrifying experience. For the past few days, most of our officers have had a serious view of the case. They now admit that it presents a real problem and are working hard to find a solution. For their present attitude, most members of the police force deserve commendation. As a matter of fact, their hesitancy in taking a genuine interest in the case at the start should not be considered. We suppose it is natural for the pride of policemen to be stunned a bit when a crime is committed. For this reason, there has been a tendency in Mattoon police circles recently to conceal from the public the fact that certain crimes have occurred. This whole line of reasoning, however, is wrong, and this has been proved countless times to the satisfaction of the county's greatest detectives. There are comparatively few types of crimes where any advantage can be gained by suppressing news or pretending to ignore the offense. The simplest reasoning tells us that any criminal realizes that his crime is going to be detected and that he will be hunted. The actual result of ignoring the crime, almost invariably, is loss of public confidence in the officers. In reality, the public does not expect policemen to prevent crimes and does not censure them when crimes are committed. The primary job of policemen in the eyes of the public is to catch criminals and bring them to justice, thereby deterring others who might be considering an offense against society. The public is loyal to its officers as long as it can feel assured that they are doing their best. But there are two serious defects in our police department that should be corrected. One is that we have less than half enough regular policemen. The normal official reply is that the city does not have enough funds to employ more. Our solution to that would be to raise more money through taxation. If the facts were clearly presented to the people, we predict that the plan would receive substantial approval because citizens want adequate police protection and are willing to pay for it. The other glaring fault appears to lie in divided authority. Commissioner Thomas Wright, under the law, is supposed to be the top man of the police department. He is a servant and would like nothing better than an excellent police force. Yet we strongly suspect that his efforts have been hampered by another city official. The latter should leave direction of the police department to Commissioner Wright. Policemen who continue to take direction from the other official should be discharged at once, and the entire city commission should support Commissioner Wright if he ever finds such action necessary. The political machinations of one he-man must not be allowed to undermine the efficiency of the entire police department. End quote. XOXO, sincerely, Commissioner Wright.
I'm just kidding. It does kind of feel that way though, right?
Back to the gasser. The gasser was at it again that same night, but now he was getting sloppy. Or, in my opinion, even more bizarre. Leroy Cook was a night shift taxi driver just going about his rounds when he actually drove through a cloud of the mysterious gas as he turned a corner onto DeWitt Avenue. By the time police arrived on the scene, a small crowd had already congregated within the gas zone. The crowd included two reporters from Chicago newspapers who later said that they and up to 70 others who had gathered at the scene had all inhaled the gas and were now experiencing symptoms in their mouth, stomach, and limbs. I personally wouldn't go running into or loitering around toxic gas fumes, especially having heard of the gas attack victims and their symptoms, but hey, what can I say? I guess I'm just a fucking genius. The now dissipating odor was described as smelling identical to that of the previous victims. The source seemed to be centered near the outside bedroom window of C.W. Driscoll's house, and that was on the corner of DeWitt. Oddly, though, police could not detect the gas inside the house. Was it a failed attack, or was it just a gust of wind, seeing as this has gone down in history as mass hysteria? But the gasser was not to be deterred. In the late hours of Saturday morning, the gasser struck again. He hit a home on the far western edge of town on an unincorporated culvert. Genevieve Haskell, her son Grayson Wayne, and house guest Mrs. Russell Bailey, and her sister Catherine Tuzo were all asleep. They had left a window open to cool the house down, and that proved to be a mistake. Almost simultaneously, they all awoke nauseated and vomiting with parched lips and mouths. IDPS Superintendent Richard Piper was now publicly stating that this was the strangest case that he had ever worked, but that he was intelligent, possibly brilliant, and that the gasser was, quote, mentally unbalanced, end quote, but that he was, quote, intelligent, possibly brilliant, the man is a nut. End quote. He ruled out the likelihood of the perpetrator being a peeping Tom, but would not elaborate on his ideas on the gasser's motives. It was clear now that neither money nor sexual gratification were his intent. That same night, Lewis Hardin reported a gas attack against his sister-in-law and his son Joe, whom she was babysitting. The two were sleeping in twin beds in the same room, and the gas had come through an open window and caused nausea and burned throats. The same night, in a rural residence 4 miles south of Mattoon, the gasser struck again. A window screen was slashed and noxious gases sent wafting through the residence owned by Stuart Scott. Inside were Stuart's family and house guest, James Tanner. They stayed inside the home and called the sheriff, but the gas was overtaking them and they ran out of the house and a half a mile down the road to the nearest neighbors. Next, the gasser returned to the northwest corner of Mattoon. Mary Fitzpatrick had been playing cards with her husband Kenneth when she got up to go to the kitchen. The second she stepped inside, she was hit by a burning vapor that made her immediately run to the sink to vomit. Her husband heard her gagging, came to check on her, and was hit with identical symptoms. The couple rushed to Mattoon's Memorial Hospital. Mrs. Fitzpatrick was diagnosed with acute anxiety and was ordered to rest. Mr. Fitzpatrick, having just suffered through similar symptoms, did not agree with his diagnosis. Neither do I. Then another bizarre twist. If this guy is real, he's truly fucking deranged. The same night as the Fitzpatrick attack, the gasser then hit Francis and Maxine Smith again, apparently his favorite victims, because this is, yes, the fourth time that he's gassed them. Remember the people who were gassed 3 times? Yeah, he went back. Is it just odd or just a coincidence that the only person to receive multiple attacks from the gasser is the principal of one of the grade schools of the area of Mattoon that was under attack? The Mattoon police were being scrutinized like never before. Prominent business owners were calling out Chief Cole's leadership and his staff's inability to apprehend the gasser. Also, you know that scathing letter when they're talking about the other person in charge? It's Chief Cole. Chief Cole fucking blows ass. He is a horrible police chief. He's a horrible police man, and he is a piece of shit. And now people in the town also know this, okay? And they want this problem to be solved. Obviously, they don't want to keep getting gassed. So now they're like, we got to do something about Chief Cole. He's a problem. Rumors of town meetings and discord were printed by Chicago newspapers, turning Mattoon itself into a very juicy soap opera. But police were working the case, kind of. For days, the Mattoon police had been focusing on a single suspect. They had been eyeing an amateur chemist whose recent behavior had become increasingly antisocial. The police intended to keep this suspect a secret, but somehow a Chicago newspaper got a hold of this information and printed it. This leak made the Mattoon Police Department pissed off and embarrassed, and they denied their suspicions about the mad scientist. They now claimed that not one but 4 individuals were considered suspects. Commissioner Wright described them as 2 home chemists and 2 crackpots. The names of the 3 additional suspects were not, and to this day never have been, released. The police never mentioned them again. The same newspaper did discover that the first suspect had been under constant police surveillance for the past 24 hours, but the mad gasser had struck multiple times within that period. Also, gonna say it here, I think this first suspect is also the guy they found, quote, lost and wandering around town right after a gassing had occurred. In what was most definitely an unpopular move, Police Commissioner Cole announced that no further reports would be taken without the victim first consenting to being physically examined, or the only other option was spending the night in prison. On Sunday night, a woman clearly triggered by nerves and anxiety nearly caused a mass stampede when she screamed out about being attacked during a movie at the local theater house. She was taken by police to the same doctor that had examined Mrs. Fitzpatrick and told her like she was fine and nothing happened. And he proclaimed this woman to be overwrought with nerves and sedated. Just like all women should be, according to Captain Cole and this fucking doctor. Seeing the scorn and embarrassment that this diagnosis brought to her, it was clear to Cole that mandatory examinations would be the rapid deterrent to the reporting of an attack. He was correct. Very few people wanted to risk the ridicule. It's called victim shaming, and it's been around a very long time. People who remember the gassings firsthand say that there were other gas attacks, but that few were willing to report them and submit to the obligatory examination. The next day, Monday, 10 Illinois State Police officers in 5 squad cars arrived in town to boost the patrols of the city. People at this point were camping out at police headquarters and following every squad car that left the station to see who the next victim was. The Mattoon Police Force at this time did not have radio-equipped squad cars. When a call would come in, an officer from headquarters, who was always on call, would go directly to the victim's location. Chief Cole was now threatening to arrest anyone following a police squad car. The next day, Tuesday, Cole was quoted in the newspaper as saying that the case of the Mad Gasser was, quote, a mistake from the beginning to the end, end quote. Quote, local police, in cooperation with state officers, have checked and rechecked all reported cases, and we find absolutely no evidence to support the stories that have been told. Hysteria must be blamed for such seemingly accurate statements of supposed victims. However, we have found that large quantities of carbon tetrachloride are used in the war work done at the Atlas Imperial Diesel Engine Company plant, and that it has an odor which could be carried to all parts of the city as the wind shifts. It also leaves stains on cloth, such as those found on the rag at the Cord's home, end quote. W.J. Webster, plant manager at Atlas, not only denied all allegations, but called them ludicrous. He pointed out that the primary use of carbon tetrachloride at the plant was in their fire extinguishers, and that it had been used at the plant and numerous others like it for years, and not a single employee had ever complained of symptoms related to it. Webster even went so far as to bring in an agent from the state health department to investigate the possibility of the plant giving off noxious gases. The report that was filed backed Webster completely by confirming that there was, quote, no possibility of tetrachloride vapors getting into the outside atmosphere in any amount of concentration that would even closely approximate a toxic condition, end quote. Boom, bitch, mic drop. So Cole is saying that somehow this gas not only blew around town, entering only certain bedrooms, but somehow it intensely concentrated itself on a random rag outside of a Mattoon residence. What a fucking dumb nuts. For the next week, calls to the police about the gasser stopped. So did calls to the police in general. Yes, that's right. Chief Cole's scare tactics seem to have worked. The final appearance of the Mad Gasser were finalists for the most interesting of them all. Both were elaborated to Chicago newspaper reporters rather than to the police due to the aforementioned crazy victim-shaming reasons. BT Dubs, the new rumor around town, originated from the town's only professional fortune teller, who claimed 2 sightings of the Mad Gasser and 1 collapse caused by him, and that the gasser was not human at all. Rather, it was a spectral ape man with a spray gun. The majority of the town chose to ignore her. The very last recorded attack claim was made by a 54-year-old widow, Bertha Bentz. She reported that in the early morning hours of Monday the 11th, her bedroom, like many before her, was sprayed and filled with a sweet-smelling gas that was accompanied by strange noises coming from her front bedroom window. The gas caused her to become nauseous and to nearly faint. Her sons, awakened by the alarm in her voice, ran outside only to witness a short, heavy-set, dark-clad figure running away and turning down a back alley. The sons, while looking at their mother's damaged window, noticed a set of footprints in the flower bed outside of her window. These prints were clearly made by women's shoes with high heels, not pumps or stilettos, but conservative work-style 1940s shoes. Pics will be included, you know where to go. Whether the residents of Mattoon liked it or not, and they did not, Chief Cole's tactics ensured that the case of the Mad Gasser was officially and forever closed. To properly delve into this case and its theories, we need to also discuss the time period, condition of the world, and society at the time, and how these factors affected and created this whole debacle. The Gasser was a drama that, if played out in today's world of school shootings, gang warfare, and domestic terrorism, would not create near the fear and stir that it did in local headlines, national news, and the collective American psyche in 1944. We have to think about how different the world was back then. To get a more realistic portrait of life then, the best way to do it is by looking at the daily newspapers. The war in Europe and the Pacific was in its second to last year. Hundreds of thousands of preschool-aged children living in England had never seen a lighted city. America was turning on President Franklin D. Roosevelt and the ever-increasing loss of freedoms that they were now experiencing. The War Department continued its constant propaganda to ensure the ongoing support of war efforts, even as they sent home long lists of casualties instead of young men. In the beginning of 1944, the influenza virus swept through the country. Time magazine went so far as to say that not a single person in America was left untouched by the illness. Now weakened by this virus, people also fell prey to the more deadly pneumonia bacteria at an alarming rate. A now female-dominated American society tried to keep morale high. Wives with children, alone due to husbands serving overseas, left their homes to live communally with other families in similar situations. Radios were still the primary source of popular entertainment, and most every home had at least one. In 1944, 5% of Mattoon's population still existed without electricity. Iceboxes were still the norm. Slightly more than half of Mattoon was linked via telephone. The daily newspaper, the Journal Gazette, and the old-fashioned sharing of town gossip in the downtown business district were the primary ways to get and spread information. They lived through an age of rationing, restrictions, and daily anguish and worry. Not all the women were at home, though. The WAC, Women's Army Cadets, became increasingly popular as the catchy advertising slogan, quote, "I would rather be over there with him than at home without him," end quote, proved to be a lure many could not resist. In 1944, many common citizens across the nation were actually talking about mystery gases. This is an important note. One most frequently mentioned was for the new miracle gas, that's in quotes, DDT, only for you guys because I love you. Diphenol trichloroethane. Nailed it. The U.S. government was willing to admit for the first time its extensive use of this new chemical on the general public. Rather than creating fear, though, chemistry was still looked upon as somehow holding, locked in its mystical formulas and reactions, the secrets to solving the problems of daily life. The problem solved by DDT was to some nations deadly and to the U.S. annoying. Insects. The U.S. Surgeon General's office went so far as to declare, quote, "DDT will to preventative medicine what Lister's discovery of antiseptics was to surgery," end quote. That will be a whole ass episode, let me tell you. Claims such as the eradication of the housefly and cockroaches and elimination of malaria being carried by mosquitoes were tossed around as advertisements. Back then, it was considered proper and almost expected that a refined gentleman would have his own library study and not all too infrequently, his own laboratory. A look into any toy store would reveal a section not present in the toy departments of modern day, the chemistry section. It was also not uncommon on any high school campus to find more than a handful of students who would unabashedly proclaim chemistry to be their hobby and primary interest. It was most definitely a different world that created and witnessed the mad gasser of Mattoon. Could another time and place have witnessed the same kind of outbreak? The answer is yes. The presence of a mad gasser is not at all unique to Mattoon, Illinois. The World War II period alone saw the manifestations of three such entities. An area of Virginia, northeast of Roanoke, known as Botetourt County, made up of a small group of tiny villages, wrestled with their own mad gasser a decade prior to Mattoon. The village of Fincastle is where it all began on December 22, 1933, with a triple attack. The farmhouse occupied by Cal Huffman and his family of eight noticed a gaseous odor wafting in through an open window. Cal's wife became nauseated and chose to retire in bed to recover. More gas was smelled 2 hours later. Cal notified the sheriff, who, when he arrived, could not find the source. No sooner had the sheriff departed from the property than attack number three occurred, this time sickening the entire family to the point that a physician was called. Through a half-open window, two family members believed they saw a figure fleeing the house after the last attack. A search of the area found footprints, seemingly made by a woman's high-heeled shoes, located near the window and under the porch. Within a week, two more attacks were recorded. In Cloverdale, a couple fell ill from a sweet-tasting gas in their home just minutes after arriving home from Christmas church service. Then later in the week, in Troutville, another odd attack was reported. A gas was released from an upstairs bedroom window. As seen in other cases, occupants in other rooms of the house did not even notice the sweet gas as they slept, let alone suffer from any of the ill effects. The Roanoke Times hastily ran features on the gas man, but quickly ran out of material when the attacks ceased for 2 weeks. It was assumed that whoever or whatever it was that was responsible for the attacks was finished. This was regrettably premature. From January 11th through the 24th, a total of 7 additional gas attacks were reported to the county sheriff. The assailant managed in that time span to hit the villages of Howells Mill, Bonsack, Carvin's Cove, Pleasantdale, and Colin, unfortunate name, and then Troutville once again.
Because fuck Troutville.
Just kidding. The gas always smelled sweet and was defined as a chlorine compound by a local doctor. The symptoms were always choking, nausea, and in a few cases, numbness of the limbs, and general weakness. In more than one of the cases, an individual or several people were seen leaving the premises, including the last attack, in which 4 people were caught fleeing from the house into an adjacent cornfield. Shots were fired at the figures. On January 30, 1934, the Botetourt County Board of Supervisors offered a reward of $500, or $11,619 today, for the apprehension of the culprit or culprits. At the same time, the Virginia legislature passed a bill making it illegal, punishable by way of 20 years in prison, to, quote, release noxious gases in public or private places, end quote. The next 10 days were a soap opera as the county split between those who honestly feared for their safety and actively stuffed their keyholes at night, and those who began to scoff at the claims of attacks and began leaning more towards the idea of mass hysteria. By the 11th of February, following a slew of clearly false reports, the Roanoke Times mounted a full 180-degree retreat and conceded that the county, quote, has no gasser, end quote, and that the incidents were imaginary. Of course, upon the publication of that editorial, the reports of gassings in Botetourt County ceased altogether. In the same year as Mattoon's gas attacks, the small town of Coatesville, Pennsylvania, suffered a far more tragic visit from a mad gasser. It was February 1st, 1944. A family home, as well as the neighboring house occupied by an elderly couple, rapidly filled with a sweet-smelling gas. The older couple was able to flee their home and seek medical attention, unaware that the same fate had befallen their neighbors. They did fully recover, but the cause of their illness was never identified. Sadly, the occupants of the other home were not so fortunate. Eventually, authorities found all 3 residents of this home dead of asphyxiation. They had seemingly dropped right in the middle of their nightly chores and relaxation, apparently succumbing to the same sweet gas. There is also a case from 1961 in which a Houston, Texas church mysteriously filled with a sickly sweet gas during a Christmas service. The parishioners suffered the same symptoms as those from Botetourt and Mattoon. All recovered within a matter of hours, and like Mattoon and Botetourt, no source of the gas could ever be identified. Dr. Stephen Clark of Canastota, South Dakota, recalled a case of a phantom anesthetist from that town in the early 1950s. The victim was a patient of his named Matilda. He withheld her last name for her family's sake. He retells the story that one night Matilda called the local telephone exchange at the time, frantically reporting that her house was under attack and that she could see and smell a gas with an odor like mustard coming from under the door and through a window. Pearl Gordon, the phone operator at the time, having no idea how to handle this, contacted Dr. Clark's father, an attorney in town who lived across from Matilda. She asked him to go take a look over at Matilda's house. He reported nothing strange, so Pearl attempted to set up a conference call with Matilda and Mr. Clark to have him calm her down, but was unable to do so because Matilda was choking, gagging, and quickly breaking up. Not like physically, she was breaking into pieces, but the phone line was breaking up. When they finally got into her house, authorities found an incapacitated Matilda, but no trace of gas was detected. Rumors spread that she was going senile, fucking gossiping assholes, but no other unusual events or behaviors were ever attributed to her before or after that single event.
The last situation worthy of a comparison to Mattoon's Mad Gasser actually had absolutely nothing to do with a gas at all. In 1962, a textile mill in Strongsville, Ohio, suffered through what has now come to be known as the June bug epidemic. It involved an alleged insect that was never identified, and it was the month of June, hence the name for the incident. The epidemic began when a disoriented female employee became nauseous and broke out in a rash after she claimed to have been bitten by an insect which she alleged to have originated from the fabric that had just arrived from England. Many testified to the fact that she did react as one would to a bite and did show a mark from it. The next day, several other employees sought medical help for similar symptoms, many dropping right at their work spot. Needless to say, watching their fellow employees dropping like flies soon created an anxious, intense environment in the factory. At the end of 3 days, a total of 63 workers had fallen prey to the bug with nearly identical symptoms. When the media finally got involved and featured the scare in the local newspaper, the factory's management decided to shut the plant down for 24 hours and have the building searched for insects and then fumigated. Actually, good owners there. The collection yielded a grand total of one black ant, one housefly, a couple of gnats, a small beetle, and one mite. A subsequent test for environmental toxins was negative and inconclusive. Following the plant's fumigation, management and health officials from Atlanta, Georgia, concluded that the epidemic must have been the result of simple psychosomatic and psychogenic factors and was clearly a case of mass hysteria. This declaration brought an end of the reported bug bites. Dr. David Miller, a professor of sociology at Western Illinois University and author of a widely used college text on collective behavior, is considered one of the nation's foremost experts on mass psychogenic illnesses. When he speaks on the June bug incident, he notes a few anomalies in the case. The first comes from his life experience because he once lived in the same area as the textile plant. He notes that in 1962, in June, in an open window factory, the collection of 5 to 6 bushels of insects would be far more believable than the announced finding of only 5 or 6 total insects. The other point he agreed to is that the label of mass hysteria is almost exclusively used in cases of what seems to be contagious behavior among females. The original scientific study on the Mad Gasser of Mattoon was quick to point out that most of the gas victims were female, but failed to note that most of Mattoon at the time was female. His statistics noted that Mattoon was only 52% female, while the sample of victims was 93% female. Mattoon's female population was easily in the 70 percentile range due to the men fighting overseas. Likewise, it is always noted that 61 of the 63 insect bite victims at the textile plant were women. This statistic is misleading, though, as the plant's employee population was 95% women. This is literally in every fucking mass hysteria case. It is always them saying all the victims were women, therefore it is mass hysteria. Great scientific conclusion, you fucking misogynistic pieces of shit. We'll talk even more about it in the next episode, which ties into this case. But back to I'm going to put my rage away and we're going to get back to this. So when asked whether an identical incident occurring at a 95% male populated factory would have been so quickly written off as mass hysteria, Dr. Miller conceded that in all likelihood, it would not have been. Like Mattoon, when officials finally decreed the scare to be only mass hysteria, no more cases were reported. It is human nature to avoid ridicule, especially among close peers such as co-workers and even superiors. If additional gassings and subsequent bites had occurred, employees would have been far more inclined not to report the incident. They might blame their illness on some other factor rather than being labeled hysteric, a term that in this time period carried great shame. Unfortunately, the label of mass hysteria seems to have become an all too convenient method of silencing a crowd during an embarrassing situation, the very kind that the Mattoon Police Department and the textile plant's management were dealing with. Police Chief Cole was the first to officially label the Mad Gasser of Mattoon as a case of mass hysteria. In retrospect, it seems rather suspicious how convenient this diagnosis was for him at the time. He and his department were coming under increasing fire due to their failure to apprehend any suspect. A few months later, this label would forever be, by science, labeled an incident of mass hysteria. A well-respected scientific journal, the Journal of Abnormal and Social Psychology, published a report of a study undertaken by Donald M. Johnson entitled The Phantom Anesthetist of Mattoon, a Field Study in Mass Hysteria. Today, Dr. Robert E. Bartholomew of James Cook University in Australia is the most read and prolific author in the field of mass hysteria. As recently as 2001, he referred to Mattoon's gasser as the best-known case of mass hysteria in the 20th century, and also the most widely cited by scientists over the past 100 years. Throughout this, it is also argued that the gasser was not a case of mass hysteria, more importantly, that mass hysteria incidents amongst adult populations are, with exceptions, extremely rare. Some people are even doubtful in its very existence. Hi, it me. When one begins investigating the gasser, the initially published study and diagnosis are imposing. After all, they were sculpted by a doctor and distinguished professor of psychology at the University of Michigan and author of numerous texts, including widely used textbooks on the psychology of cognitive thought. But guess what? We're going to take this guy down anyways, because he is wrong. What is never mentioned or noted, though, is that Johnson was, at the time of the research and publication, no more than an undergraduate student taking a lower-level psychology course. He was most likely a freshman or sophomore at the University of Illinois. Mattoon being 50 miles to the campus made the town a convenient research site for an undergrad research project. Johnson then had the help of his professor at the time, Dr. R.P. Hinshaw, who had Johnson's work published through a sponsorship. Gotcha, bitch. Johnson's final paper, though it reads impressively, is flawed. Johnson's first flaw lies in his interview subjects. Upon informing the people of Mattoon that he was in town to do a study on mass hysteria, the victims wanted no part in his research. The ridicule they had already endured had caused them to not want to speak about the incident. His interviews, therefore, were predominantly focused on the testimonies of Mattoon police officers, mainly Cole, who had proposed the hysteria hypothesis in the first place and then shamed the entire town into keeping silent. This is a problem for a research paper. And who just wanted this whole thing to be swept under the rug? Great sources, dickhead. Secondly, in full knowledge of the current thoughts on mass hysteria, Johnson deliberately skewed the list of victims. He was not seeing where his research took him. He went in with an objective and an idea of exactly what he wanted this case to look like, and then skewed everything to fit that narrative. He would oftentimes list a wife as a victim when in fact a couple had been attacked, then consistently failing to consider or record any of the children or adolescents who were affected by the gas. Neither the two Chicago newspaper reporters who reported becoming ill from the gas, nor any of the crowd of almost 70 individuals gathered at one time within a cloud of the gas were accounted for or spoken to. Throughout his report, he referred to the sensational reporting by the Chicago Herald American as being a key source of panic-inducing propaganda. Only in passing, though, does he mention that a mere 5% of Mattoon's households had read the paper every day, these being most likely the most wealthy 5%, living outside the lower middle-class areas of the attacks. One of Johnson's primary arguments for the hysterical nature of the gassings was how, when the police finally cracked the case, newsflash, they did not, please take your fake college essay and sit down, they had announced that the entire episode had been, quote, a mistake from beginning to end, end quote, and that there was no gasser, the number of calls to the police of gassings immediately dropped to zero. Not only that, he went on to point out that for the 3 weeks following the police's announcement that there were absolutely no calls at all reporting a prowler of any sort, this was, in the history of the department, unheard of. Johnson claimed that the Mattoon population experienced a period of shame and embarrassment upon realizing their error and overcompensated through a period of overcautious skepticism. What Johnson forgot was that the dramatic drop-off in gassing reports was clearly due to Chief Cole's threat to arrest anyone who reported a gassing without submitting to a medical examination. Such an examination had already shown to reveal nothing. This dickwad action by Cole created an attitude of resentment, fear, and a lack of trust for the Mattoon Police Department. Even today's highest profile authority on the Madgasser of Mattoon, Bartholomew, presents to his readers several strikingly erroneous and misleading facts about the case, including reports of sightings that did not occur. The true facts until this book I am using as my source have been hard to come by. Good job, Scott Maruna. You're doing God's work. In popular literature, mass hysteria goes by several names, but not all mean the same thing. Mass psychogenic illness, mass sociogenic illness, mass panic, social contagion, hysterical contagion, and collective delusion have all been used at times interchangeably for mass hysteria. Mass psychogenic illness has a three-part definition. First, it happens among a group of people. Second, it manifests in a portion of this said group as physical somatic symptoms. Thirdly, genic implies created, and psycho translates to mind. Therefore, mass hysteria is a group of somatic symptoms manifesting and is created by the collective mind of a distinct group of individuals. Many events fall within the realm of collective psychological behavior, but they should not be, yet all have been, grouped with Mattoon's Madgasser. Often referred to as the most famous case of mass hysteria in history, incorrectly so, was the 1938 broadcast of Orson Welles's The War of the Worlds. So, they put out over the radio to America a newscast-like version of this play, and they broadcast it on the radio. So people listening to the radio thought that this shit was actually happening. A lot of people, which is hilarious, but also like really fucked up. So these people thought that Earth was being invaded by Martians because the news broadcast on their radio was telling them that that was true. This is not mass hysteria, okay? A large number of people were deluded by that radio station into believing that the events described in the play were actually occurring. Many people responded with behavior relative to that belief, but there were no physical or somatic symptoms at all with any of these people. It was clearly a case of a portion of the American radio listening population succumbing to a collective delusion, one that they were fed, basically. But this is not mass hysteria. Often forgotten in history is an almost identical repeat of this collective delusion that occurred in 1949 in Quito, Ecuador. A local radio station, without forewarning to the listening audience, aired a Spanish version of the radio drama with the settings altered as to be regional. An eerily similar result swept over the area as thousands of frantic people fled their homes, armed themselves, and prepared for battle with aliens. Only this time, the event ended in disaster. Upon finding that they had been duped, the angry mob turned on the radio station and burned down the building, killing 15 of the employees. I might have to do a whole ass episode on both of those cases, because that shit is pretty... What? Who thought that this would be a good idea? Hi, I'm Karen, and I would like to speak to the manager, because who the fuck thought that that would be a good idea? Twice. In 2001, New Delhi, oceans away from the rumors of Bigfoot and Sasquatch in the US, was in complete turmoil and terror over an elusive monkey man, or black monkey. Several individuals were tragically trampled to death by chaotic mobs as they fled from areas where the monkey man was supposedly sighted. The entire event has been classified as a mass hysteria, but actually should be called a mass panic. The monkey man panic peaked in a resettlement colony during the summer months, when water was scarce, prolonged power outages were frequent, and most people slept in lightless streets that actually were terrorized by brazenly aggressive monkeys. Due to the complete lack of symptom manifestations, this period and place in history was obviously a panic and not a mass hysteria. Some sources, such as the Chicago Tribune and the Tribune of India, when commenting on mass hysteria, have even tried to find parallels between Mattoon's Madgasser and the post 9/11 anthrax scare in 2001. Very soon after the initial anthrax attacks, a deranged individual entered a busy American subway station and sprayed a liquid vapor all over the area and onto hundreds of horrified onlookers. When questioned after being rushed to the hospital, 35 of the individuals who were sprayed reported suffering from symptoms such as nausea, headaches, and/or sore throats in the days following the attack. Fortunately for the victims, a toxicologist's report showed that the liquid that they were attacked with was a weak glass cleaning solution. Psychologists were quick to point out that the illnesses expressed by the victims were classic indicators of another example of mass hysteria. Their case was chalked up as psychogenic illness. Some observers of the media noted the similarities between this event and Mattoon's gassing drama of 1944. Sadly, this event has actually been used as proof that there was no actual gasser in Mattoon. This is not a great conclusion. Not only were the two cases nothing alike, but the subway scare itself was not even mass hysteria. If you look at the first six victims of the Mad Gasser, the Kearneys, the Rafes, and the Riders, outside from the war that was occurring thousands of miles away, these families had no logical or justifiable reason to fear a sweet-smelling scent coming through their bedroom windows. It is worth noting that Aileen Kearney, upon first detecting the gas, thought that it was nothing other than the flowers outside of her window. There's nothing directly or indirectly frightening about the smell of the gas. It was not until the nausea and or numbness began that fear and panic set in. There was no cause for these three sets of individuals to have unconsciously manifested their symptoms from the given sensory trigger. The subway victims, on the other hand, had every reason to fear for their health and their lives after being sprayed with this substance. On everybody's mind at the time were the anthrax letters and the anthrax-related deaths and the now very present threat of bioterrorism on American soil. Had they been sprayed 2 years earlier, maybe none of them would have suffered symptoms. Not to imply that the illnesses were hysterical or even the victims were hysterical. Their fears were real. We would have all been afraid had that happened to us during that time period. Nausea is a common result of acute and intense stress and panic, first and foremost. Then, at that moment in history, there was perhaps nothing more stressful, frightening, and panic-inducing than the thought that you were possibly just sprayed with anthrax. As one's metabolism skyrockets in fight-or-flight mode, the digestive system begins to shut down dramatically, causing the stomach to be upset and also causing vomiting. Likewise, in times of acute anxiety, all the muscles of the human body undergo an involuntary flexing to some extent. In times of severe stress, people's fingers are not extended, but are in the shape of a fist or at least curved in. This is due to minor muscle contractions. The exact same phenomenon occurs on the scalp. Our craniums are sheltered within smooth muscles that also contract in times of emotional trauma. All of these muscles are flexing together and against each other and create a constrictive squeeze on the brain cavity. This squeeze is more commonly known as a tension headache. Many people within 24 hours of a large stressor will have a sore throat. A percentage of the human population are living incubators, continual hosts for repressed viruses. The viruses do not spread or generate symptoms due to the fact that our immune system is strong enough to keep the infection at bay. The increased metabolism necessary for the body's unconscious stress response drains energy from the body's immune system. Normally, non-expressive viruses that cause sore throats attack and multiply during and shortly after times of stress. Therefore, it is no surprise that the numbers of the spray victims suffered from sore throats. The subway attack following September 11th, 2001 was clearly not mass hysteria and therefore had nothing to do with and is definitely not comparable to the Mad Gasser of Mattoon. If these widely known cases, often cited as mass hysteria, are not mass hysteria, then what makes a case an actual case of hysteria? That is difficult to pinpoint and seems that every reference or text has its own definition of the phenomenon. In actuality, there are some psychologists who question whether the actual phenomenon itself even exists or whether the term has been too loosely and generically used. Hi, it's me. I don't think it exists. I think that there's a reason for every incident and it's different in each case. We're not going to talk in this episode about the dancing plague, but I'm sure we will get to it and I'm sure you all know of it. That was also kind of said to be mass hysteria. We're going to tackle that separately. The most disturbing thing about modern academic work on hysteria is that the literature seems to be based on Johnson's first incorrect report. All of it is based on this one undergrad douchebag dickhead who was wrong and only interviewed the police. And that is not a good basis For example, Dr. Ruth Angs of Indiana University, considered to be a consulting expert in the field of epidemic hysteria and mass psychogenic illness, where she broke down the symptoms and characteristics of mass psychogenic illness into 11 points. Events describable by or containing many of these 11 traits can, in her opinion, be labeled as a case of mass hysteria. The fault in this is that it is based on and created from a review of approximately a dozen cases that have already been labeled somehow as mass hysteria, including Johnson's report on Mattoon. Therefore, we are left trying to define hysteria using the assumption that the gasser was mass hysteria. This is problematic science, okay? For sure. And we're going to look at her list of 11 common traits, and we're going to talk shit about them because she's fucking wrong. And that's what we do here. Dr. Eng's symptomology and characteristics of mass psychogenic illness. Point 1. Sudden onset of dramatic symptoms with rapid spread and rapid recovery. What is dramatic? What's a dramatic symptom? How dramatic are we talking? I'm very dramatic. My dramatic symptom would be different from someone who's not dramatic. Is muscle weakness, as in what happened in Mattoon, is that dramatic? Even if we call the recovery period in Mattoon rapid, you can't call the spread of it fast. The gasser is different from nearly any other case on record. Over and over again, it can be found that mass hysteria episodes spread in a matter of hours or a couple days at most. No other case of hysteria spread continuously for as long as Mattoon's attacks did. 2. Predominantly young female populations. You're wrong. Sorry. Again, in the official study, it says that Mattoon was 52% female. The gasser victims were 93% female. But that's not right. He is wrong. Johnson was manipulating the facts to appease the current academic theory at that time on mass hysteria. Did he lie? If you consider manipulation of facts lying, then yes, he straight up fucking lied. 3. Victims often know each other or are in the same friendship circles. Many of the Mattoon victims did not know each other. They were not friends. They were not family. They didn't have social connections. They just lived in the same town. That's out. 4. A triggering stimulant, olfactory or visual. So the trigger in the case of Mattoon was a permeating, sweet-smelling odor. But it wasn't like the train spraying, where everyone was sprayed at the same time with the same substance. They are talking about one mass incident collectively experienced by a group. And Mattoon was not that because they were individual incidents. You're getting a waft of an odor in different houses all over the county that a lot of people don't even, they're not triggered by. One thought it was perfume, another thought it was flowers. That didn't trigger them in any way. It was experiencing the symptoms that freaked them out and caused them to panic, which it would with anyone. Also, they weren't all together to get triggered by a singular stimulant. Does that make sense? So it doesn't really fucking apply here, this lady's research. Chief Cole did try to say that there was a singular stimulant. I don't know if you remember, but he tried to say the diesel plant was somehow wafting fumes all the way across town, all over the place, that randomly concentrated to high levels in certain houses that were not only scent detectable, but also toxic. That is some bullshit, and we all know it. I'm skipping number 5 because it's stupid and it doesn't make sense. Number 6, negative laboratory or physical findings. It is true that few physical clues were found related to the gasser, but how many items or how much evidence would you expect a mad gasser to leave behind? No fingerprints would be left, as there's no need for the gasser to touch anything. Or would you expect to find a few scattered items dropped by the gasser in a hasty escape? Would you maybe expect footprints outside of a victim's window? The police found both of those things. So this point does not add up to Mattoon's gasser scenario. 7. Underlying psychological or physical stress. None of these people had that. 8. Boredom. No. These people were living their lives. They're just busy people living their lives, working the farm, raising their kids. They're not bored enough to one by one make this shit up. And how much more bored would you have to be than any other small town in America? Why would this be different though? 9. A lack of emotional or social support. Sure, this is an isolating farming town during the largest war in history, and that war removed a large portion of the town's male population. This begs the question, why Mattoon? Why was Mattoon so much more stressed, bored, or lacking in support than any of the hundreds of other small towns all across the United States in 1944? How is this little town any fucking different than any of those other towns? 10. Unrelated symptoms among a group of individuals. Dr. Engs notes here that hyperventilation and fainting are the two most common and prevalent symptoms of mass hysteria. Mattoon's victims didn't do either of those things. 11. Relapse of illness. There was only one relapse of illness, and that was the principal of the area's elementary school, who was attacked 4 separate times. Also, interestingly enough, 2 of the gasser victims were hardcore believers in the theory that the gasser was a case of mass hysteria and a figment of people's imaginations. Why would these people allow themselves to then participate in the mass hysteria? Not to say mass hysteria never happens. I kind of said that. It does happen with juveniles. Juvenile mass psychogenic illness is actually far more common than most people believe. A look at the most recent cases of large-scale mass hysteria around the world shows an interesting trend. In 2002, a Nairobi preparatory school was temporarily closed when 7 girls ages 12 to 14 fell into unstoppable screaming fits. In 2001, 30 high school girls attending a school assembly in Japan inexplicably started screaming and collapsed. 1999, more than 100 Belgium middle school students were hospitalized with a mystery illness within a 3-day period after drinking Coca-Cola. In 1999, a New York City middle school watched as 80 students and a teacher all fell suddenly and mysteriously ill. Hundreds more were sick the next day. 1999, St. John's College in South Africa suffered through hundreds of adolescent-aged girls experiencing fits of shaking, rigidity, and foaming at the mouth. 1998, Warren County High School in Tennessee has 170 students hospitalized in the course of 2 days. All claim to have smelled gasoline-like odor. 1992, nearly 40% of adolescent girls at a school in Iran who received their annual tetanus shot fainted in school during the course of the next 3 days. 1989, 63 out of 150 children, average age 9, 75% female, attending an unnamed daycare in Florida fell victim to sudden attacks of nausea, headaches, and cramps. I mean, I still think a lot of these things can be explained. I really do. I don't think they're all mass hysteria. But these cases represent only a small fraction of the occurrences of mass hysteria in the last several decades, but almost all of them are eerily similar to those presented here. They are almost exclusively occurring in juvenile populations. I haven't done a deep dive into the cases of juvenile mass hysteria, so I can't fully give my analysis of these cases and if I think they're real or not. I will just say, in general, I do not think mass hysteria is real in adults. I do think it's a little more possible in juveniles, just because of the lack of brain development and the burning need to fit in with everyone around you. But again, I think there could be a very real source of these juvenile illnesses as well, and it's entirely possible these cases were not mass hysteria. In February of 1994, Gloria Ramirez was dying of cancer at the Riverside General Hospital in California. Her physician, Dr. Julia Gorchensky, needed a blood sample for a routine test. As the needle punctured her skin, Dr. Gorchensky and soon 10 other hospital employees who were in the general vicinity smelled the distinct odor seemingly coming from the patient. Within minutes, all 5 of the aforementioned 11, including Dr. Gorchensky, fell to the floor incapacitated while the remaining 6 staggered out of the ward. In time, the hospital wing was evacuated, but not before a number of individuals succumbed to a total of 23 symptoms of central nervous system maladies and malfunctions, such as muscular spasms, weakness, and headaches. The mystery of the gas lady remained unsolved for months until investigators finally announced that they had cracked the case in September of the same year. The California Department of Health Services officially announced that the conclusion of their study showed that the victims of the supposed gassing had actually been victims of their own nerves. Yep, This case was labeled as mass hysteria. When asked her opinion of the department's conclusion, Dr. Gorchensky replied, "The health department's report is bullshit. They have come up with conclusions based on only partial data. They did not refer to my medical records or the toxicology report from the coroner's office or wait until the final analysis." Dr. Gorchensky's physician echoed her conviction by adding that, quote, "She had too many things wrong with her to make it hysterical bone necrosis, elevated liver and pancreatic enzymes, gastritis, hepatitis, and unexplained crystals in her own blood that were seen by a doctor and a nurse in different hospitals," end quote. I have written an entire episode on this case. That is just the overview, and we're going to do a comparison to the Madgasser of Mattoon. That is the tie-in for next week. It's really, really interesting, and I dug really, really deep into it. So we are going to break that down next week. But to utilize that case as a comparison and contrast to the Mattoon-Gasser, two key points of terminology must be highlighted. The first being simply she. It was previously mentioned that the word hysteria has been eliminated from modern scientific literature and replaced with psychogenic illness. Hysteria fell into disfavor due to the word's origin. Just as in hysterectomy, the root term for hysteria refers to a woman's uterus or reproductive capability. In the 19th century, it was common practice by male doctors to treat female hysterics with uterine manipulation that basically involved massaging a woman's clitoral region to the point of orgasm. Yeah, you heard that right if you didn't already know that. Hysteria was clearly an exclusively feminine problem. In the following century, as the term became more and more common in the American vernacular, its use became far more commonly flippant or derogatory, rather than in the psychological sense. Having this now insulting term linked to a single gender seemed inappropriate to those in academia. Though the name change has been academically accepted, it seems someone forgot to inform the psychosocial researchers that the change was made for a reason. Nearly all cases that were and are diagnosed mass hysteria in the past century have involved primarily females. I have been using the term and will continue to use the term mass hysteria because I think the whole diagnosis of mass hysteria is as outdated as that term is. And both, quite frankly, ridiculous and yes, most definitely derogatory towards females. And so, a little tongue-in-cheek, I'm going to continue to call it mass hysteria, basically because I think that it's bullshit. Readers of mass hysteria literature read of hysteria spreading through a female-staffed textile plant of 100,000 females who worked themselves into a hysterical frenzy at the death of Rudolph Valentino and now the females of Mattoon. Sociologists Dr. David Miller and Dr. Robert Bartholomew both admit that the gender of the afflicted victim or predominant gender of a group is a factor in the speed in which a diagnosis of hysteria is rendered, if not the final fucking judgment. The most haunting question I ask about a mass psychogenic illness diagnosis is, do women fall victim to hysteria because they are women? Or do women who fall victim to a toxin-induced illness become labeled as hysterical because they are women? It is the latter far more often than the former. Another key terminology of the case study is the term modern examination. In today's technologically advanced age, along with the financial resources and contacts available to Dr. Gorchensky, she was able to have a diagnostic test run on herself that was impossible in 1944. And those findings added to her counter-argument against the mass hysteria diagnosis. Sociologists and psychologists argue that symptoms manifested externally, such as nausea, fatigue, and muscle spasms, can be triggered by the fooling of the central nervous system. It is true that one can be psychosomatically stricken blind due to stress and anxiety through a mental illness known as conversion disorder. A young woman stricken with conversion blindness truly is blind. She would not simply be imagining herself to be blind, as one would suffering from hypochondria. The catch is that if this woman were exposed to every battery of tests known to modern ophthalmology, absolutely no cause for the blindness would be located. No physical hindrance to the light hitting the retina would be found. There would be nothing anatomically wrong. The light would travel to the eyeball itself, nerve to brain, just as it should. The origin of her blindness would be in her brain. It is refusing to accept and recognize the sensory nerve messages from the eyes. The same explanation could be made with only a few minor adjustments for a case of conversion disorder creating paralysis. A person suffering from conversion paralysis, as Johnson suggested to have occurred multiple times in Mattoon during September of 1944, is truly paralyzed, but would show no organic roots or causes for the condition upon testing. Similarly, one can induce oneself to vomit by manually stimulating the bitter taste buds at the rear of the tongue, thus fooling the brain into believing the body has just swallowed something that it shouldn't have. There is no use in arguing against the fact that the brain could be duped and that symptoms can be elicited for physical and emotional reasons. What is disturbing in the above scenario, though, and what counters the hysteria label, is the fact that Dr. Gorchinsky was suffering not only from external nervous system manifestations, but also from key organic symptoms that did show up in a physical. Even more damning to the diagnosis was the clear evidence that she was infested with an unknown chemical residue in her bloodstream. Digestive enzymes, unlike behavioral hormones, are released only in the presence of a physical body. The liver produces excess toxin-eliminating enzymes only in the presence of excess toxins. The human body cannot create a foreign, inorganic, crystalline substance in its own blood due to stress. Had the mad gasser of Mattoon struck in the 21st century instead of 1944, the victims could have been administered a modern examination and might have been found to possess similar microscopic, enzymatic, and bloodborne symptoms, as well as the external manifestations. Most of Mattoon's residents would not have any idea what the fuck you're talking about if you were to ask them about the mad gasser or the phantom anesthetist. College students studying psychology, however, might know what you're talking about. It is not an exaggeration to say that 100 times more people outside the city of Mattoon are familiar with the gasser than people in the town itself. A whole new group of people became acquainted with the story in the 1970s due to a young man named Lauren Coleman. Coleman of Decatur, Illinois, is one of America's most popular and respected... Are they respected? Okay. Is one of America's most popular cryptozoologists. I love you, cryptozoologists. Don't come for me. I know we all know this, but a cryptozoologist is a researcher who investigates the possibility of the existence of undiscovered species of animals. His work had largely centered on a cluster of sightings of a black-colored, panther-like big cat in and around Decatur, and even the occasional story of a stray alligator around town. He was the first to write about the possibility that Mattoon was not in hysterics in 1944, but rather was haunted by a cross-dimensional entity. The theory of multiple dimensions is one that has been talked about and researched by physicists for years. Even though this might seem strange, we will talk about it because we're going to cover everything. Also, remember Mattoon's psychic that everyone tuned out. Interesting. And one other event that occurred not too far from Mattoon with eerie similarities. There is one person from this story of the mad gasser that claimed to have gotten a really good look at the gasser himself. And that was Mrs. Edna James, a self-proclaimed psychic and spirit-sensitive fortune teller / owner of the Lincoln Inn in Mattoon. On the night of September 7th, while lying in bed, she detected an odd odor coming from her kitchen. When she went to investigate, she saw a very hairy, Neanderthal-like man with stooped shoulders, exceedingly long arms, and facial warts, an ape man of sorts, armed with some sort of spray gun. When the entity realized that it had been caught or seen, it spoke in unrecognizable grunts, aimed the spray gun at her, and proceeded to gas her multiple times. Her arms and legs quickly lost sensation and she collapsed. As Mrs. James reeled from the attack, the gasser made his dashing escape. She claimed a second meeting 2 days later. While working the counter in her motel lobby, the gasser literally just meandered into the room. There were several guests in the lobby at the time, but only Mrs. James was able to see the gasser. It was when the gasser realized that she could see him that he literally disappeared into thin air. Most have written off Mrs. James's testimony as an attempt to draw business to her motel and psychic side business, but it's difficult to see how such a plan could have made that happen. It certainly has never been proven, and in fact, it did kind of make her an outcast that everyone completely disregarded. once she came forward with that story. Did not drive business for this lady, that's for sure. Are certain people attuned or more sensitive to the presence of spiritual entities? Of course, we cannot prove that. Science can't prove that. But the magnitude of attention that ghosts and other entities receive from popular culture really does at least cause the world and science to take notice of the possibility. Although you don't find groups and organizations hunting down and investigating leprechauns or unicorns, thousands of such gatherings and organizations are centered around ghosts and other spectral creatures. And here comes in that one other bizarre incident I spoke of before. Momo, the Missouri Monster. For a very short and chaotic period in 1972, the small town of Louisiana, Missouri, that's a town, Louisiana, Missouri? I never knew that. Was haunted by a humanoid beast that roamed through the hills outside of town and right through the property of Edgar Harrison. This town is approximately 4 hours from Mattoon. Momo is the name for the beast based on Missouri, which we all know is M-O, and monster. And this creature has many similarities to both the Mad Gasser and Mrs. James's story. Both appeared out of nowhere during the late summer. Both were seen in a rash of sightings for approximately 12 days. Both then disappeared to never be seen again. Both remained within a very limited boundary range. The Gasser to the northwest quadrant of town and the Momo to a distinct set of hills south of Louisiana. Both were described by some witnesses as half-ape, half-man, with long arms, but not unnaturally tall. Both were reported grunting and making gurgling noises. Both were capable of spraying a noxious gas. The Momo was seen only rarely, but its smell was unmistakable. Strangely though, this odor did not seem to passively originate from the creature. Instead, it came on with such intensity and force, then disappeared just as rapidly after approximately 5 minutes, which led researchers of the paranormal to agree that the odor had to have been directed and sprayed in a manner reminiscent of a skunk. It was hypothesized that Momo used the spray as an attention-diverting escape tactic. Both were impossible to catch. Twice, teams tracking the Momo felt they were just about to come upon it when the men were hit with a blast of nauseating gas and the Momo just seemed to disappear. Are these similarities simply coincidental or is there just too much here to ignore? Maybe the Mad Gasser of Mattoon and the Momo were the same type of creature or the same creature altogether. Both, by the way, with women's shoe fetishes. If that is the case, this human-like entity seemed intelligent and curious. The Gasser moved through town only under the cover of darkness. The Momo occupied an abandoned hunter's cabin. It seemed that its gas was not immediately sprayed or released, but prior to its disappearances released. Could the entity's mode of movement between dimensions be aided by the distraction and confusion caused by the gas? How could an ape man stroll through Mattoon, even at night, undetected? Maybe the gasser was not being a malicious attacker, but rather a foreign visitor. The gassings were not done offensively, but rather defensively. The gas acted as a distraction for escape. The only detailed descriptive sighting of the Momo was given by three children, which many have argued that children are more spirit sensitive than adults. Troy Taylor, a longtime researcher into paranormal phenomena, has always been fascinated by outbreaks of strange activity centered around certain geographical areas. Taylor explains that activities around what he calls flaps are usually short-lived but intensely active. He points to West Virginia's Mothman as a possible flap stereotype. His model would have entities crossing into our world from an entirely separate reality through a teleportation type mechanism, almost as if a door or portal to this other reality opened in a small restricted area. Taylor argues that this hypothesis could not only explain the Mothman, but a plethora of various phantom animals and attackers that have turned up throughout history in places they clearly should not have been. It could even explain Mattoon's Mad Gasser. Okay, now let's talk conspiracy because we have to. You know, everyone loves a fucking conspiracy. Every unsolved case has its own conspiracy. I am not on conspiracy talk, but I do believe in some of the conspiracies floated out there in the ether, and they've always fascinated both me and the general public. Could Mattoon's Mad Gasser have been a large-scale U.S. military cover-up? We have covered the American government's experiments on the U.S. citizens in the Oakville Blobs episode. We know for a fact it does, and it will, and it has happened. Ad nauseam. For decades. And they do mostly target smaller towns, although they're not above dousing all of San Francisco in chemicals. Many have speculated that both Mattoon and Batatat County, Virginia, were actually visited by operatives of the military's chemical warfare testing departments. It was suggested that these agents were there to spray randomly selected individuals with various newly concocted war gases in order to gauge their effectiveness before approving them for mass production. One concrete clue that does seem to lend credibility to this hypothesis is the strange incident in Coatesville, Pennsylvania, earlier in 1944. Did the military show up in Coatesville and spray experimental gas into a couple of houses only to find that the gas was too potent? Three people died from that gassing. Following that tragic incident, there were no further gassings there. Did the military slink out of town in the night and work on the chemical makeup so that it doesn't kill people until they were ready? They toned it down and they were like, hey, let's hit Mattoon, Illinois. Also lending to this kind of conspiracy is the fact that the Mattoon gassings stopped at a point that seems illogical. If you were to graph the number of gassings versus time, it would be obvious that the gassings stopped very abruptly, at least 7 days just following what would be the peak of the graph. It had to build to this point. People that love charts and psychologists would argue that it would take at least that long for the phenomena to gradually fade away. Then there's the question of why the U.S. military would bother going through all of this trouble and risk to illegally test a gas that caused only nausea and numbness. But once again, going to the Elkville Blobs episode, they do this all the time, even testing chemicals that have mild flu-like symptoms. They're most often testing how the infection process works, not the infection or the gassing or the chemical itself. They already know what the chemical does. They're testing how to best implement this chemical, how to make sure the agent works in the way that they want it to and affects the amount of people that they want it to. The idea that the Mothman, Bigfoot, and Mattoon's Mad Gasser all travel through a parallel universe during exceedingly rare and ever-changing portals is fun. The government does indeed test on American citizens. However, I don't think that that is the case here. As far as the Mad Gasser of Mattoon is concerned, let's step back into reality. The Mad Gasser of Mattoon's name was Farley. Scott Maruna did this work in this book, okay? And he talked to the people and he got to the bottom of this shit. I am just telling you the story as a podcaster and in interjecting my own opinions, of course. But I would like to just shout out, you should get this book. It's really good. And he did a lot of work. And I believe him. It was fucking Farley. Farley Llewellyn was the Mad Gasser of Mattoon. We all know it. We all love it. It is criminal profiling, which was born in Britain and became what it is today at the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia. As I'm sure you all know, through this process, investigators use only clues and evidence in an attempt to paint a portrait of the culprit in descriptive terms. This description then allows police to narrow down their hunt, saving valuable time and sparing future victims. Though it's too late to capture the gasser, the process can still be utilized for this case to recognize the truth behind the case and to dispel the hysteria. The profile of Mattoon's gasser reads as follows. There was more than one gasser, as conflicting eyewitness reports described dramatically different body shapes. One of the culprits was tall, while another was short and obese. At least one of the culprits had an extensive knowledge of organic chemistry. The culprits lived in the same general vicinity of the victims. At least one of the culprits had the ability to move about town inconspicuously. The culprits had reason to possess anger against society in general, which was manifested in the gassings. This whole description brings us directly back to Farley. A large proportion of Mattoon's elderly population knew and know today that Farley was responsible for the gassings. Why the silence then, as Mattoon went down in history as the town that was gripped by hysteria but was actually terrorized by a crazy person? Why wouldn't someone speak up? The lack of anyone challenging Johnson's study, Hull's hypothesis, or the Chicago newspaper's articles about the backward, susceptible town had everything to do with the incredible loyalty and respect the town gave parents and family. It is only now, when there are no longer any living relatives to this family, that neighbors and citizens are willing to tell us what they know. Farley's family owned and operated a neighborhood grocery store at 920 DeWitt Avenue in Mattoon. The store was truly a family operation. Farley manned the register while his sisters Florence and Catherine did the cleaning, what little was done. Yeah, that's shade. You'll see. It seems that the Llewellyn Grocery was known in town for, to phrase it politely, being untidy. Many former customers said that they used to dread shopping there and begged their parents to go elsewhere due to the sheer number of cats that could be found lounging throughout the store and on top of the produce and food. Would you like some fleas with that sandwich? Apparently, the sisters' lack of cleanliness was a personal issue as well. All who remember Florence and Catherine were quick to note their most memorable traits. It seems that they were both heavyset girls who always wore frumpy floor-length dresses, maintained poor hygiene, and never brushed their hair. The two never married and remained recluses throughout their lives. Living next door to the Llewellyn Grocery was the Breeze family. Mrs. Breeze was a mother of six children, left widowed at a tragically young age. One of those children is Charles Breeze, who at the time of this book being written was 84 years old and a decorated war veteran of World War II. While describing the Llewellyn family, he remembered fondly that every Christmas Eve, Farley's father would come next door to their home, bringing two bags full of food. One bag always had an assortment of candy hidden at the bottom, which was a luxury for the struggling family, and a little secret wink wink nice thing for the kids. Farley's father was a pillar in this community. He was the kind of gentleman that extended credit to all neighborhood families at his store, and then, upon his death, noted in his will that all debts still owed to him at the store were to be forgiven. That is so sweet. All who knew him, which was basically the entire town, held him in the highest regard. When he could be located, Farley would be found at the family store also. But Farley was the only one rarely seen working. Most remember him as always sitting at the counter with his nose buried in a textbook. Farley was considered to be one of the town geniuses. Same Farley. He had an exemplary record at Mattoon High School and had excelled as a chemistry major at the University of Illinois. But he had returned to Mattoon. The outside world was too much for Farley to handle. The only place he felt comfortable was in his own laboratory. Farley's father was rich. Hey, Daddy. So much so that throughout his fraction of the family wealth, Farley designed, built, and equipped a full-scale cellar chemistry lab for himself. At this point, Farley's in his 30s, and he chose to no longer live in the family home, but lived one block west of the store. He moved into a trailer that was in the Llewellyn's backyard, adjacent to his little cellar lair. It was here that he worked in a secret laboratory that all the neighbors knew was absolutely no secret. Farley was not good at keeping secrets because Farley drank a lot. In his bouts of drunkenness, Farley said far more than the town wanted to hear. Kathy Upton was raised next door to Farley's little gross room lab and the Llewellyn's residence, and remember clearly being able to see him through her window. She describes him as having been a loner. He got along with very few people. His drinking was a problem, but not nearly his worst problem. After graduating from university, it had become very obvious that his behavior and mannerisms had grown more odd and less sane. Most of the town was convinced that Farley was losing his mind. The family did what it could throughout the years to hide Farley's odd behavior, his drinking, and also another secret they were keeping from the town. He was a homosexual. Unfortunately, the gossip mill spread this news a long time ago, and now they were linking this information with his diminishing sanity. Obviously, we know those things are not related at all. That's fucked up. But there were also rumors regarding Florence and Catherine's gender preferences, but the sisters, unlike Farley, never gave away the slightest bit of evidence to indicate a preference either way. What Mrs. Upton remembered most about Farley was an incident that occurred in late August of 1944, just 1 week prior to the first gassing. Mrs. Upton was in her room when she heard a huge explosion. Rushing to her window, it was obvious that the explosion had come from Farley's laboratory as smoke billowed out from the doorway. The trailer had clearly been damaged in the blast and was now standing at a slight slant. That's hard to say. Eventually, Farley emerged tattered but claiming to be unharmed. Neither he nor his sisters, when later pressed by neighbors and the police for information, would ever reveal what had caused the explosion. Farley did not seem disappointed, though, and was far from being deterred. Mrs. Upton said that in very little time, Farley was back at work in his repaired laboratory, but it would only be for a few weeks. By mid-September, at precisely the time the gassings ceased, Farley would move away from Mattoon. His home for the next dozen years after that would be a mental hospital. Dun, dun, dun. Farley is an almost perfect fit to at least part of the aforementioned profile. Farley, the obvious chemical genius behind the gas synthesis, was the real gasser. In a fit brought on by mental instability and years of pent-up rage against a town that would not allow him to be himself, Farley fucked around with various organic solvents in an attempt to create a suitable weapon. Early on in the Mattoon attacks, chemists and two FBI agents were consulted in an attempt to identify the gas or vapor the Mad Gasser was using. E.E. Richardson, Mattoon's mayor at the time, assured his constituents that the gas could not have been chloroform, as was widely believed around town. The newspaper's use of the word anesthetic and chloroform's well-known distinctly sweet odor made it a popular culprit in town gossip. Richardson explained that chloroform, once diluted in air, was simply not strong enough to have caused the symptoms described by victims. So what the fuck was being used on these people? There is an option that would not have required the gasser to be a chemical genius at all. Rather, it could have been anyone who owned a refrigerator. In 1944, before the invention of Freon, the most common refrigerant gas was chloromethane. This gas has a very sweet scent, and in cases of inhalation, nausea, vomiting, confusion, uncoordinated movements, and fatigue were common results. This gas also has no irritating effects on the eyes, unlike many other gases. This is a distinction that is important because none of the gassing victims ever said that they had any irritation or problems with their eyes, which is very unusual for a gas, a chemical gas, okay? So it has to be one that doesn't cause irritation to the eyes. The catch about the chloromethane is this. It only exists as a gas. The cloth found propped against Mrs. Cord's front door, which was spot-soaked with an oily liquid, produced an identical concentrated scent, the same as the sprayed gas. Therefore, the gasser's gas was not actually a gas at all, but rather a vapor of this oily liquid, potent enough to induce mucous membrane, respiratory, digestive, and central nervous system disorders if diluted in air, an evaporable oily liquid. Then there is only one possibility, tetrachloroethane. Today, the EPA has halted all commercial production of it, but in 1944, it was used by organic chemists and in industry in large amounts as an intermediate in the production of numerous other chemicals. It was also used occasionally as a metal degreaser or as an ingredient in pesticides. It is a clear oily liquid that is extremely volatile with a sweet fruity odor. Breathing high levels of this in can cause fatigue, vomiting, dizziness, and possibly unconsciousness. It has little to no effect on the eyes and possesses the quality of having almost a 100% recovery from the above symptoms as soon as the exposed person is moved into fresh air. It's sounding good, right? The gas that was said to be non-existent that caused symptoms that disappeared within what was said to be impossible rapidity was not a phantom gas at all. True, you would be hard-pressed to come across this chemical now, but Farley, with his extensive knowledge of solvent chemistry of the 1940s, would have been all too familiar with this easily vaporizable liquid. BT dubs. I know I keep saying I love him, but this guy who wrote the book, Scott Maruna, is a chemistry teacher. No one is better suited to unravel this case than him. I believe him because I don't know chemistry at all, and he does. So I'm believing him on the chemistry of this gaseous substance. On August 31st and September 1st, Farley started with three gassings. All three were couples in their 30s and had been schoolmates with Farley at Mattoon High. So they're the same age, and he went to school with them. He knows them. Unfortunately, far too many years have gone by to know what these students had done to Farley in the past to earn their target status. Whatever his motives, though, was Farley trying to anesthetize them? If one were to line up all of the possible gases that could be used and eliminate all that are not sweet-smelling, clear, oily, evaporable, highly volatile liquids that do not cause eye irritation but do cause anesthesia, nausea, minor respiratory hindrance, severe burning and irritation of the mouth and nose, and swelling of the lips that can be synthesized easily and stored for at least 2 weeks, the one and only perfect match would be nitromethane. The gasser spray was described by one victim as being reminiscent of cheap perfume. Nitromethane smells that way. So under this theory, Farley Riley either synthesized or acquired an amount of nitromethane prior to his first attack. His first attempts at working with this dangerous liquid proved disastrous for his laboratory, causing the explosion. Nitromethane remains stable for approximately 16 days. With this knowledge and some simple math, it can be determined that his supply would have been degraded by September 11th. The Mad Gasser's last attack was September 11th, 1944. Nitromethane has a comparatively high evaporation rate of 1.39, therefore the amount necessary to make a circular splotch on the center of a 6-inch by 9-inch rag, such as the one recovered by Mrs. Quartz, so it would have evaporated in less than 24 hours. The 3-day procrastination by state police in chemically testing that cloth was not only inexcusable, but a major turning point in the investigation. And not in a good way. Nitromethane will elicit identical symptoms from inhalation as were reported in Mattoon, but that is not what this chemical is known for. Nitromethane is known for one thing, combustion. It is known for the sheer power stored within its highly reactive bonds. It can be assumed that Farley's initial nitromethane explosion in his lab was unintentional, but maybe it was a catalyst and an inspiration for what he was about to do next. He discovered a weapon powerful enough to do damage, and yet untraceable by the forensics of the time. In the first reported case, Mr. Kearney claimed to have seen and even pursued the gasser outside his home 2 hours following the actual gassing. His description of the gasser's body type, tall, medium build, fit Farley's description. Farley was approximately 6'2 and 200 pounds. Why did Farley return to the Kearney home? It would have been too late for him to observe the nauseating effect of the gas on his victims, so he wasn't going to revel in their suffering. What though if the whole intention behind the gassings was to ignite the gas? And upon it not igniting as quickly as he intended, he would return to the houses more than once to try again. And once he realized he could not get it to ignite after several tries, he accepts that this gas is making people sick and terrified, and maybe by that point, that's good enough for him. And lo and behold, a mad gasser is born. After the first attacks, there was a 3-day gap in the distribution of newspapers due to a weekend and then Labor Day. There were no gassings during those 3 days after the first attacks, okay? So Farley, having not been successful with blowing up the houses during the first 3 attacks, is probably like, this isn't working, I'm gonna stop now. But then 3 days later, the newspapers hit, and bitch, they hit hard. 3 prominent gasser researchers, Johnson, Bartholomew, and W. Smith, all agreed that the Journal Gazette was almost exclusively responsible for the mad gasser hysteria. And maybe that's a tiny bit true. Had the newspaper simply reported Kearney's incident as a case of illness by gas, it's possible no further gassings would have occurred. Tuesday afternoon's edition of Mattoon's Daily Journal headlines screamed of an anesthetic prowler on the loose and told of how Mrs. Kearney and her daughter were the first victims. Farley's failures were turned into victims. In his mind now, the whole debacle, the whole failure is now a success. And the label of anesthetic prowler, that was now a mask to hide behind. If he couldn't execute his vengeance individually and quickly, he would get there by terrorizing the entire community slowly and through fear. The one component of the criminal profile that Farley does not match relates to the gasser's ability to move about town inconspicuously. The mad gasser must have at times been able to simply walk away from a crime scene, and if he was seen, not be suspected. Farley could not have accomplished this. Not only had Farley always been the town weirdo prior to the gassings, but midway through the gassing scare, he became police's top suspect and was under constant surveillance. And probably that guy that they found outside of one of the first gassings. Remember, they wouldn't say who it was, and he said he was lost? Yeah, I think that's how the police had their eyes on him in the first place. So now, how could Farley have completed the last half of the gassings? That is easy. He did not. So the second half was hysteria. Absolutely not. It's at this point that the plot thickens. So both Mattoon police and Illinois State Police were patrolling the streets as well as armed vigilantes. Everyone was looking for the gasser. a man. Women walking through neighborhoods, especially those traveling in pairs or groups, would never have been suspected to be the gasser. A woman could have committed the gassings and calmly walked away without raising the slightest alarm. Charles Breeze remembers his mother telling him that Farley had used a woman's perfume bottle to commit the gassings. How she knew this is uncertain, but it is an interesting idea. The perfume bottles of the 1940s were constructed of glass and possessed a large bulb which, when squeezed, provided the propulsion necessary to vaporize the liquid and expel it through a little barrel. A bottle such as this could have been easily tucked into a purse or up a sleeve. Also, having an item like that would have been completely normal for a woman. On September 7th, following an early morning mass attack, a night owl neighbor spotted a tall, thin man fleeing the scene. But the police had, by that time, officially made Farley their prime and sole suspect. They placed him under constant surveillance. Farley's gassing days were over, but the gassings continued. Farley was the mad gasser of Mattoon, at least the first one. What if, in truth, the Llewellyns were the mad gassers of Mattoon? Farley had a younger brother, but he, disgusted by the town's attitudes towards him and his siblings, left Mattoon long before 1944 and moved to Alaska. That leaves Farley, Florence, and Catherine. They were the mad gassers of Mattoon. All who knew them spoke of the tight bond of loyalty between the siblings. The actual reason for his sisters continuing the gassings when Farley's jig was up, nobody really knows, of course, but we can definitely parcel it out and sort it out of why they would do that. Most likely the women were attempting to take suspicion off of their brother by continuing the gassings while he was under surveillance, therefore leading police to say, it can't be Farley, he was under surveillance that night and there was another attack. It reminds me of that fucking serial killer and he smuggled a condom full of jizz to his girlfriend and then she was supposed to go out and murder someone. I think she did actually, and plant semen on the body to prove that it couldn't be him. That does sound dumb now, but this was back before they could do DNA and know exactly who the semen belonged to. It would just match the other semen on the other victims. It's very much that whole idea, right? Like, it can't be my loved one because this is still going on. That shit is very realistic. I could see that for sure. Also, the last half of the gassings were different from the early attacks. They became sloppy, more scattered, and far more personal. Farley's early targets had primarily been couples and families that were his age, peers from high school that lived in his own neighborhood. The women now shifted their aggression to targets in a younger age range and tended to focus more on single women. Later attacks were obviously aided by the Llewellyn family car, to which the women had access. The Driscoll gassing, the one with the large crowd of people, must have been an accidental spillage of the nitromethane to have created the outside cloud of vapor that temporarily existed. The assaults ended on the 11th. The reason was seemingly threefold. First, the nitromethane that Farley made was by this point degraded and he could no longer use it. Secondly, the women had showed their sloppiness by leaving a clue found underneath Bertha Bence's bedroom window. The footprints that were there were made by one of the women's high-heeled shoes. This short, portly woman to whom the shoes belonged was spotted by one of Mrs. Bence's sons fleeing from the neighborhood. This final attack had revealed too much. They also left behind a skeleton key and a tube of lipstick. The last reason things ended was Farley himself. The Llewellyn family, perhaps suspicious, perhaps knowing, could no longer deal with Farley's mental health crisis. Right around the 11th, the Llewellyn family had Farley placed in a state mental institution. He would remain there for the majority of his life. His placement there was done with the utmost secrecy. Rumors eventually spread, but few people would speak of it in public as to not embarrass or shame a family that they held in high regard. Even to this day, some of the older folks of Mattoon are still reluctant to speak about it. When asked about Farley's connection to the Mad Gasser, simply say, do not ask too many questions. The very next day after Farley was committed, the Journal-Gazette's words and tone proclaimed the gassing case to be over. It was at this point that the Mad Gasser of Mattoon shifted from its place in the nightmares of Mattoon citizens to its illegitimate home in the textbooks of psychological history. We see you, Farley. And we know what you did that September. And that is the case of the Mad Gasser of Mattoon. But we're not done quite yet. I have a little treat for you. To end this case today, we are not doing animals. They're fucking cool. But we are going to go over the menu of the original Burger King, the one made famous in Mattoon, Illinois. The one I mentioned at the very beginning of this case, the one that sued fast food chain Burger King and won. This restaurant opened in 1952, so not long after the gassings, and it is still open today. And you and I, we're going to go over the menu. You know a bitch love food. Okay, so what can you enjoy at the original Burger King in Mattoon, Illinois? We've got, it's very cheap, first of all. I'm shocked. The most expensive thing is $6, but generally everything is like $2 or $3. That's insane. You can't get a glass of water in Los Angeles for less than $6. Okay, you can enjoy a junior burger, junior cheeseburger, hamburger, cheeseburger, double cheeseburger, double burger, king burger, triple burger, a hooter. I don't know what that is, but I want one. You can have a double hooter, triple hooter, pork tenderloin sandwich, fish sandwich, a BLT, grilled cheese, crispy chicken sandwich, grilled chicken. You can add bacon cheese to anything. You can get a pronto pup. I'm not exactly sure what that is, but it's the same price as a hot dog. You can get a Blues Hog pork barbecue sandwich for $4.29. Yes, please. You can get chicken tenders. You can get a cheeseburger family pack for $15, and that's four burgers and a pound of fries. You can also do that with a double cheeseburger family pack. There is a kids menu. Fuck kids, I'm not doing that. You can make any item a combo for $2 and adds a drink and a fry. You can substitute any drink that comes with a combo for a milkshake for $1. Yes, please. So they have regular fries. They have a pound of fries. They have mushrooms. I'm guessing those are like sauteed little button mushrooms or maybe even fried. Yum. You can get onion rings, mozzarella sticks, chili. They have milk, coffee, soda. Ooh, the other menu is called Frigid Queen. Oh my God. It's my new username on everything. And on my dating apps, Frigid Queen. You can get ice cream cones, vanilla chocolate, twist, or lemon, or flavor of the week, which I would love to know what that is. You can get sundaes, and you can top it with chocolate, butter pecan, peanut butter, hot fudge, pineapple, raspberry, blueberry, strawberry, marshmallow, or chocolate and marshmallow. And they all come with whipped cream and a cherry. You can add extra toppings or nuts. You can add pecans or peanuts, crushed or whole. Shakes, they have vanilla chocolate, strawberry, pineapple, lemon, orange, raspberry, hot fudge, marshmallow, yum, peanut butter, butterscotch, banana, cherry, and blueberry. You can malt any of them for 40 cents. They have root beer or Coke floats. They have a banana split with pecans, whipped cream, and a cherry. They have a double banana split. And then they have glaciers, which is like a blended ice cream blended with stuff, I'm guessing. Because you can get cookie dough, Oreo, butter pecan, Reese's peanut butter cup, M&M, Snickers, Heath bar, Butterfinger, banana split. Also, you can get a quart or a pint of ice cream and they deliver. And you can order by phone. It looks delicious. It doesn't have pictures of the food. It's just the menu. But like, you know what you're walking into. A small town burger joint like that. That shit's going to be greasy and it's going to be fucking lit. I want to go so bad. I might just put Mattoon, Illinois on my travel list. I'm not even kidding you. So yeah, that is the case of the Mad Gasser of Mattoon. Also, not going to lie, on my eBay wish list, I found all three of the bubblegum cards with the Mad Gasser on them. And then I found like a three card little holder stand that you could prop them, like make them look nice or whatever. I don't know. People collect stuff. I don't collect shit, but like a, you know, collector's card little frame thing. And I absolutely am going to be getting those. And I looked into the toy, but it's kind of stupid, so I don't think I want that. But I do want to go to the Burger King, and I do want to get those playing cards, memorialize this weird fucking case. I hope you enjoyed it. I will talk to you very soon. Okay, bye. Get me a double cheeseburger and a marshmallow shake and some onion rings and mozzarella sticks. Full source notes are available at mistressofthemacabrepodcast.com, as well as photos pertaining to each episode. Follow along on Instagram for all the insane and gory photos at Mistress of the Macabre Podcast. please leave a 5-star rating and review wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps the show grow, and I will love you forever. And tell a friend, if you even have any. Bonus content is available at patreon.com or on Apple Podcast subscriptions. I'm just one young teenage girl writing, researching, producing, editing, and recording the show. Your support goes a long way. If you have topic ideas, questions, comments, animal facts, or unsettling stories you'd like to share, email me at mistressofthemacabrepodcast@gmail.com.